Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Chris Bascobert, your guide for this in-depth analysis of global events.
And I'm Jay Micheloni. It's a pleasure to be here.
Joining me today to really synthesize a staggering amount of information and, well, extract the signal from the noise.
It's quite a stack of material we have in front of us. And, you know, it's not just a collection of headlines. It feels more like a comprehensive stress test of the entire global system right now.
It truly does. So for today, we're doing a comprehensive and exhaustive review of the source material from Reuters for Sunday, November 23rd, 2025.
Right.
And our mission, as always, is to ensure you walk away with a thorough understanding of every major headline, its context, and its far-reaching implications. We're diving deep into politics, economics, resource strategies, all of it.
And we really have to start where the pressure is at its absolute peak, which is the Ukraine crisis. The whole diplomatic landscape has just shifted dramatically. It's gone from a slow negotiation to, well, an immediate forced ultimatum from the United States.
Okay, let's unpack this exclusive report immediately, because the core threat is, it's extraordinary. The U.S. is reportedly threatening to cut both vital intelligence sharing and weapon supplies to Kyiv.
Yeah.
This isn't a friendly negotiation. This is Washington actively trying to compel Ukraine to accept a peace deal before the holiday.
This is the defining geopolitical pressure point of the moment. It's using military aid as a blunt instrument of political leverage. And this threat, it's all centered on a proposed 28-point U.S.-backed peace plan, which is, frankly, extremely difficult for Kyiv to accept.
So what are the specific demands in this plan? What's causing so much alarm?
Well, the demands are concessionary in the extreme. I mean, Ukraine would be required to cede control over significant territories that Russia currently occupies.
Just hand them over.
Essentially, yes. And on top of that, the plan demands severe limitations on the future size of the Ukrainian military. It's basically capping their ability to defend themselves.
And what about NATO?
That's maybe the most symbolically painful part. Kyiv would have to officially renounce any and all future ambitions of ever joining NATO.
Wow. That last point just fundamentally removes the very reason Ukraine has been fighting this conflict, which is self-determination and, you know, NATO as a security guarantee.
Right.
And President Trump has put an incredibly tight timeline on this.
He has. The deadline is set for this coming Thursday.
Thanksgiving, November 27th.
Exactly, Thanksgiving. Trump is expecting President Zelensky to sign on to this plan immediately. And that aggressive timeline, it just completely undercuts any attempt Kyiv might make to delay or to renegotiate. They are being forced into an impossible choice, and they have to make it within days.
And the response from Kyiv has been, you know, understandably, one of immense anxiety.
Of course. Zelensky has already warned his own parliament and the nation that if they accept this plan, they risk losing their dignity, their freedom through these concessions.
But on the other hand?
On the other hand, if they reject it, they risk losing Washington's backing entirely. A loss that could lead to military defeat within months, given how dependent they are on U.S. military hardware and intelligence. It's a true geopolitical catch-22.
So that's the impossible choice for Kyiv. What about the immediate reaction from the key European allies? Germany, France, Canada? Are they just lining up behind Washington on this?
Not at all. The European reaction signals profound discomfort with the speed and the severity of the U.S. proposal. Leaders gathered in Geneva to discuss the draft, and their collective assessment was that while the U.S. plan provides a basis for talks...
Basis for talk?
It requires additional work.
Additional work sounds like diplomatic code for this is a terrible deal and we need to avoid selling out Ukraine.
That's precisely what it means. They are trying desperately to eke out a better deal for Kyiv before Trump's Thursday deadline. They're hoping to soften the concessions on territory or the military limits. They're just buying time.
Because they know it's at stake.
Exactly. They recognize that a deeply compromised Ukraine could destabilize the entire European security architecture. And we also heard very strong opposition from Polish President Nowacki, who stated unequivocally that any peace plan affecting Ukraine has to be accepted in Kyiv first. He's emphasizing Ukrainian sovereignty despite all this strong-arming from Washington.
And this all comes at a moment when Ukraine is grappling with dual crises, the external pummeling from Russia and, well, internal political turmoil.
The pressure points are just compounding. Russia is continuing its strategy of systematically degrading Ukrainian infrastructure. We're seeing this relentless pummeling of power and gas facilities, causing huge outages for millions, especially as winter approaches.
Right. And this is designed to break civilian morale.
and to undermine the government's ability to function. And then internally, as you said, Zelensky is politically weak going into these talks.
Very weak.
He's battling a significant domestic corruption scandal. And it's not just petty graft. The investigation has ensnared people right in his close entourage.
Which weakens his leverage.
Completely, both at home and abroad. It makes it so much harder for him to resist the pressure from Washington because Trump's team can always point to these internal governance issues as a reason to cut aid.
Now, let's follow the implications of this hardline U.S. policy right here to our own shores. We are seeing a deeply cruel humanitarian fallout detailed in the sources regarding Ukrainian refugees.
This is a bureaucratic nightmare layered on top of a human tragedy. We're talking about nearly 200,000 Ukrainians currently in the U.S. who have been thrown into legal limbo.
And these are people who were admitted under the humanitarian parole program.
Correct. That program was launched under the Biden administration back in April 2022, and it covered around 260,000 people in total.
And now the expiration of this status puts them at risk of losing their legal standing, their jobs, and facing deportation as soon as March 31st, 2025. What is causing this and what's the real impact?
The cause is a deliberate policy and bureaucratic shift under the Trump administration. They paused the processing of these parole applications and renewals back in January.
Just stopped it.
Completely. And even after a federal judge ordered officials to resume processing in May, the source data shows the administration has only processed a mere 1,900 renewals since then. It is a calculated and, frankly, effective way to weaponize bureaucracy.
And the financial barriers they've put up are just astonishing, especially when you consider these families have often lost everything back home.
That's where the cruelty becomes really clear. A new prohibitive $1,000 fee was added in July for the renewal application.
And that's on top of the existing fees.
Exactly. Piled on top of the existing $1,325 application fee per person. So for a family of four, you're talking about thousands of dollars just to maintain a temporary legal status they were already granted. It's an insurmountable financial barrier designed to force people out.
There's a specific, just heartbreaking case in the sources that illustrates this perfect storm. Katerina Galizdra.
Her story is emblematic of the whole group. Her status lapsed in May. Immediately, she was forced to leave her $50,000 a year manager job at the Ritz-Carlton.
So she lost her income, her work permit.
And critically, her health insurance, which she desperately needs to manage a serious liver condition. You know, she fled Bucha after Russian troops destroyed her home, only to find herself living in fear of detention here in the U.S. because of red tape and high fees.
And the lack of options is driving people to take tragic, extreme measures, a phenomenon the sources are calling self-deportation.
This is truly shocking. We are seeing Ukrainians choosing to leave the U.S. entirely, preferring to face the dangers back home rather than risk being detained or becoming permanently undocumented in America.
It's an impossible choice.
The source highlights Yevgeny Padafa, a 31-year-old software engineer. His parole expired in September, and rather than risk detention, he chose to self-deport. His quote just sums up the desperation perfectly. He said, "If I return to Ukraine, I'll just go to the front line. I'd rather be homeless somewhere than risk the detention process in the U.S.
Wow. The uncertainty created by U.S. policy is literally pushing people toward a war zone.
It's a staggering human cost derived directly from political policy shifts.
It is. Before we transition, let's quickly look at the military action. Ukraine managed a significant strike deep into Russian territory.
Yes, this demonstrates their increasing long-range capacity. Ukraine successfully struck the Chatura heat and power station in the Moscow region with drones. This is a substantial distance, about 120 kilometers east of the Kremlin.
And the impact was immediate.
It was. It cut off heating for thousands in the town of Chatura, a town of 33,000 people. It's one of Kyiv's biggest attacks deep inside Russia, and it's designed to inflict the same kind of disruption that Russia has inflicted on Ukraine.
And tragically, the civilian toll from Russian action remains relentless.
Absolutely relentless. Last week's Russian missile strike on an apartment building in Ternopil resulted in the deaths of 34 people. That makes it the deadliest Russian missile strike targeting civilians in all of 2025. So even as the diplomacy accelerates, the ground war just grinds on.
And quickly, on the Middle East, tensions remain acutely high.
The Gaza ceasefire is incredibly fragile. We saw reports of Israeli airstrikes killing at least 20 people in Gaza on Saturday, really testing the limits of that truce. And separately, there was a specific strike on a Hezbollah militant in Beirut's southern suburbs by the Israeli military.
Which confirms that the potential for a wider regional conflict is still a major concern.
A critical concern, especially on Israel's northern border.
Okay. That gives us a chillingly detailed overview of the global conflict landscape. Let's segue now from those overseas challenges to the domestic pressure points raging right here in Washington. Let's talk U.S. politics and specifically the economic reality facing the American voter.
This is a crucial pivot because the core source of voter anxiety remains the economy, and President Trump is grappling with the same uncomfortable truth that plagued the previous administration.
Which is the political economy of high prices. The central challenge is that Americans despise higher prices, regardless of what the official inflation rate is doing. The headline figure, inflation is down to around 3% from its 9% peak, that masks the enduring cost crisis.
It does, because inflation measures the rate of price increase. When prices spiked so much in 2021 through 2023, that established a new painful baseline. And prices, you know, they seldom fall back down. They just stop accelerating. So voters feel that cumulative burden every time they go to the grocery store.
Let's talk specifics from the source material. What is driving the sticker shock right now?
We see pain across several key categories. Beef is up nearly 15% year over year.
Wow.
Coffee is up even more dramatically, over 20%. And even imported staples, you know, things like tools and hardware, they're up 6.2%. These are daily tangible expenses that keep the cost of living crisis front and center.
And the Thanksgiving metric really sums it all up.
It's the perfect metric. While the cost of a traditional Thanksgiving dinner might be, say, 5% cheaper than the absolute peak last year, the sources confirm the overall cost is still a significant 13% more expensive than it was in pre-pandemic 2019.
And that enduring sticker shock directly affects consumer sentiment and, by extension, political support.
It does. And this leaves Trump facing a fundamental policy contradiction, doesn't it? Voters want immediate relief, but his favorite economic strategies, like investments in manufacturing, take years to yield results.
Right. So the administration is trying to square that circle. They're touting new investments, creating jobs, a long-term strategy, while at the same time grasping for immediate fixes.
Primarily by publicly pressuring the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates, they're hoping to stimulate consumption quickly.
And what about the impact of the tariffs he's so aggressively re-implemented?
Tariffs are a major factor here. The administration loves to point out the revenue stream. They're citing $150 billion in new federal revenue since January. But most Americans and businesses have soured on them. They recognize these import duties are taxes paid by U.S. consumers and businesses, contributing directly to higher costs on everything from coffee to that 6.2% rise in hardware prices.
Speaking of things that did not pan out in government, we have the spectacular, almost farcical demise of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE.
This is a story rich in irony and symbolic failure. I mean, DOGE was one of the flagship projects of the administration, launched enormous fanfare.
I remember the imagery of Elon Musk, the initial head, brandishing a chainsaw at CPAC.
Right, symbolizing his intent to cut bureaucracy and waste. And now DOGE has just abruptly disbanded 8 months ahead of schedule.
And the official confirmation is brutally concise.
It is. Coming from the Office of Personnel Management Director Scott Cooper, who simply stated, that doesn't exist.
Which contrasts sharply with the claims DOGE was making about slashing tens of billions of dollars.
And that's the key. The crucial missing detail, which outside experts quickly flagged, is that DOGE provided no detailed public accounting for its claimed savings, making all those boasts impossible to verify.
So after the grand spectacle of chainsawing bureaucracy, the only measurable outcome is the dispersal of the staff.
Precisely. And where they went is even more surreal. Some prominent former DOGE employees, including one nicknamed Big Balls Corstein, have shifted their focus from eliminating waste to eliminating ugliness.
Wait, what?
They've moved to the National Design Studio, which is headed by Airbnb co-founder Joe Gebbia. And their new mission, apparently, is to beautify government websites.
So the hyper-efficient bureaucracy slayers are now graphic designers. That's quite the ideological pivot.
It is the perfect example of Washington prioritizing optics over measurable results. It's a lot easier to make a website look pretty than to demonstrate tens of billions in verified savings.
From the collapse of a federal department, let's turn to the collapse of a political alliance. the stunning news that Marjorie Taylor Greene is resigning from Congress.
This is one of the most significant domestic political fractures of the week. Greene's resignation, effective January 5th, comes after a dramatic and very public falling out with President Trump, who had been her strongest ally.
And her specific quote explaining her departure is extraordinary. Very charged language.
It is. She stated that she refused to be a battered wife, just waiting for Trump's approval and enduring continuous, painful public fights. She knew she was facing a punishing primary fight against a Trump-backed challenger, and she felt it would be a painful distraction.
Especially since her party's House majority is already so fragile.
Exactly. What specifically triggered this rupture were two high-stakes decisions she made. First, she voted with Democrats to force the public release of the Epstein files.
She said that standing up for American women shouldn't get her branded a traitor.
And second, and maybe even more damaging, she publicly called Israel's assault on Gaza a genocide. Given Trump's unwavering support for the Israeli government, that was the final line.
And Trump responded by calling her a ranting lunatic and completely withdrawing his support.
Right. And her departure is significant for Congress. It immediately narrows the Republican House majority to a razor-thin 218-213. This creates profound instability for the Speaker.
Yet, almost at the same time, we have the bizarre creation of a new political alliance that nobody saw coming. The meeting between President Trump and New York City Mayor-elect Mamdani.
This was pure political surrealism. Mamdani, the young, Uganda-born democratic socialist, ran on a far-left platform, rent freezes, free buses, free childcare. And Trump had previously savaged him, calling him a communist and a Jew-hater.
But the sources describe a warm White House meeting where Trump lavished praise. How on earth did they find common ground?
They found the shared nexus of American anxiety, the cost of living. Mamdani noted that even the Trump voters he spoke to were focused entirely on the high cost of rent and groceries. And Trump agreed. He said, some of his ideas are the same ideas I have.
The cordiality was so striking that they even joked about the past insults.
Yes. When a reporter asked Mamdani if he still considered Trump a fascist, Trump just laughed and said, that's okay, you can just say yes. It's easier than explaining it. It signaled a willingness to put ideology aside for political opportunity. He even defended Mamdani from Islamophobic slurs, calling him a very rational person.
It's an incredible illustration that high prices can trump ideology. Now, moving from political maneuvering to hard policy, the administration's immigration agenda continues to face stiff resistance in the courts.
We have three major legal fronts where the administration has faced setbacks this week. First, a federal appeals court blocked the administration from expanding expedited removal, or rapid deportations, to migrants living anywhere in the U.S.
So what exactly is expedited removal, and why is that expansion so controversial?
Expedited removal is deporting migrants without letting them appear before a judge. It's usually reserved for those caught right at the border. The administration wanted to expand this to anyone anywhere who'd been here less than 2 years. The court blocked it, citing serious risks of erroneous summary removal. It's a due process issue.
The second front involves federal grants, where the administration tried to force cities to comply with its immigration agenda.
Yes, and cities are fighting back. Chicago publicly rejected federal community violence intervention grants because the administration restructured the program to focus funding almost exclusively on law enforcement and federal immigration enforcement, cutting out community groups.
Chicago called it an attempt to politicize public safety.
They did. And this aligns with resistance from the judicial branch. Separately, two federal judges blocked the administration from imposing new conditions on hundreds of millions in DHS grants to cities like New York, LA, and San Francisco. These conditions would have forced them to drop DEI programs and help with federal immigration enforcement.
So the courts are stepping in.
They are, finding the administration likely overstepped its authority.
Finally, we see a highly targeted program termination regarding a very small community.
President Trump announced the termination of Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, for Somalis in Minnesota. TPS is a humanitarian status for citizens of countries deemed unsafe to return to. For Somalis, it's been in place since 1991.
And Trump cited unverified claims about Somali gangs and fraud.
Right. And the irony is that this highly visible move targets a tiny population. Only 705 Somali-born individuals nationwide even hold TPS status. Critics see it as a politically calculated threat against an entire community.
The U.S. domestic picture is one of profound turbulence. Let's shift now to the global economy and market stability, moving from that political volatility to monetary policy and corporate maneuvering.
It's a seamless transition because monetary policy in the U.S. is a lightning rod right now, directly influenced by that political need for affordability relief.
Wall Street certainly reacted this week. Indexes jumped as expectations of a Fed rate cut in December increased dramatically. It's now priced at nearly a 72% chance. What fueled that shift?
Two major drivers. First, mixed labor market data, which signaled the economy might be cooling. And second, and maybe more importantly, were the comments from New York Fed President John Williams.
A key voting member.
Right. He signaled a distinctly dovish tilt, stating he sees room for a further adjustment in the near term. That strongly suggests a December cut is on the table.
But the sources indicate the Fed is not unified on this.
That is the key tension. The Fed has been signaling a desire to hold rates, and members like Boston Fed President Susan Collins remain hesitant. Collins argues that policy should stay in the mildly restrictive range for now. She's pointing out that while the job market is softening, inflation is still above the Fed's 2% target.
So the December meeting could be contentious.
Analysts are predicting it will be characterized by the least groupthink seen in years. The decision is highly unpredictable.
Across the Pacific, Japan is also on the cusp of a major monetary policy shift.
This is a huge, long-awaited moment for Japan. Bank of Japan board member Kazuyuki Masu stated clearly that the central bank is nearing a decision to raise interest rates.
This is momentous because they've had ultra-low rates for so long.
For decades, the BOJ has kept rates steady at 0.5%, even though consumer inflation has been running above 2% for over 3 years. And Masu emphasized they won't wait until after the spring wage negotiations in 2026. Policy normalization is imminent.
Looking at corporate deals, we have a major media consolidation in the UK.
The Daily Mail owner, DMGT, struck a significant deal, £500 million or $650 million, to buy rival newspaper The Telegraph,
which creates one of the most powerful right-leaning media groups in Britain.
The implication is not just financial, but political. It consolidates significant media influence for the right wing in the UK.
And activist investor Bill Ackman has major plans for public offerings.
Ackman is planning dual public offerings for his hedge fund firm, Pershing Square, and a brand new investment fund, Pershing Square USA, for early next year. It's a complex but significant move to capitalize on his track record and attract retail investors.
In commodities, the copper wars are intensifying.
This battle is high stakes because copper is essential for virtually all clean energy infrastructure, EVs, wind turbines, you name it. BHK Group, the world's largest mining company, has made a renewed takeover approach to rival Anglo-American,
which is a direct challenge to the Anglo-American merger with Teck Resources.
Exactly. If BHP succeeds, the combined entity would become the world's largest copper producer, essentially dominating the market for this critical green metal.
That concentration of supply chain power is a global concern. Now let's shift from M&A to corporate accountability. And the allegations against major tech platforms are incredibly damning, starting with Meta.
Unredacted court filings in the class action lawsuit brought by U.S. school districts contain allegations of a major internal cover-up. The core charge is that Meta not only possessed but actively buried causal evidence, proving its products harmed users' mental health.
What specifically did this internal research, codenamed Project Mercury, find?
The research, from 2020, surveyed users who voluntarily deactivated Facebook and Instagram for 1 week. The suppressed findings were significant. People who stopped using the platforms reported a statistically measurable drop in feelings of depression, anxiety, and loneliness.
So this is a causal link, not just a correlation.
That's what the plaintiffs argue. Yeah. This is some of the first clear internal data suggesting that. And the response from within Meta suggests they knew exactly how sensitive this was.
I saw the quote about the tobacco industry.
Yes. An unnamed staffer worried about the situation being similar to the tobacco industry. Doing research and knowing SIGs were bad and then keeping that info to themselves. Meta allegedly called off the research shortly after, claiming the findings were tainted by the media narrative.
TikTok is facing similar accusations regarding external influence.
Plaintiffs in the same lawsuit allege that TikTok actively influenced the National PTA, the Parent Teacher Association, boasting internally that the organization would do whatever we want. The claim is they manipulated the PTA into issuing public statements defending the platform's safety.
Meanwhile, Google is battling intense antitrust enforcement.
That's right, over its ad tech dominance. The judge in the case is pushing for a quick, decisive remedy, and the Department of Justice is arguing for the most aggressive remedy possible, a forced sale of Google's AdX exchange.
Can you explain why the DOJ believes that's necessary?
AdX is the exchange where publishers sell ad space. The DOJ argues Google has created an ecosystem where they own the buyer, the seller, and the marketplace, essentially rigging the system. They claim nothing short of a forced sale can restore genuine competition. Google, of course, argues a breakup would be too extreme.
Finally, a security note. A major data breach involving third-party vendors.
Client data for major banks, JP Morgan Chase, Citi, Morgan Stanley, may have been exposed due to a hack of a tech vendor called Citus AMC. They provide back-end services for real estate lenders.
So it's a supply chain risk.
Exactly. While the FBI said they found no operational impact to banking services so far, the compromised information includes sensitive corporate data. It just highlights the growing risk posed by third-party vendors in the financial industry.
This intense convergence of market risks and corporate accountability sets the stage perfectly for our next section, which shifts focus to the existential risks of climate, energy, and global resource strategy.
These domains are increasingly linked because national security is now defined by access to critical minerals and control over data, whether that's financial data or climate data.
Let's start with the recent COP30 climate summit in Brazil. It ended in a deadlock that was only resolved through significant compromise.
The initial roadblock was the European Union. They rejected the draft deal because it completely omitted any mention of a fossil fuel transition plan. The EU delegation insisted that any final document had to signal a move away from oil, gas, and coal.
So how did the Brazilian presidency secure consensus if they were so far apart?
Brazil pushed through a deal that achieved consensus by intentionally omitting fossil fuels from the main accord. They placated the EU by issuing a voluntary, non-binding side text on the issue.
So what was the major achievement that secured the compromise?
It was climate finance. The final accord calls for rich nations to at least triple the money provided for adaptation finance to developing nations by 2035.
And adaptation finance is crucial.
It is, because it helps nations cope with the current, unavoidable impacts of climate change, rising sea levels, extreme heat. It was the necessary concession to secure buy-in, especially given the G20 declaration, adopted without U.S. participation, which stressed the seriousness of climate change in a clear snub to President Trump.
Let's examine how the U.S. and the U.K. are locking down their critical resource supply chains. This shift from political agreement to resource dominance seems to be defining global strategy.
The U.S. Export-Import Bank, or EXIM, is leading the charge. They're committing a massive $100 billion to secure U.S. and allied supply chains, focusing on three key areas: critical minerals, nuclear energy, and liquefied natural gas.
And the goal of this is to counter over-reliance on foreign suppliers.
Primarily China, yes. Early deals are already being targeted at projects in strategic locations like Egypt and Pakistan to build resilience in these supply chains. It's geopolitics disguised as trade finance.
The UK has a similar, very specific domestic strategy for critical minerals.
Britain unveiled a detailed strategy to dramatically reduce its dependence on foreign suppliers by 2035. They have concrete targets: 10% of their critical mineral demand from domestic production and 20% from recycling.
And they're focused on specific materials.
Yes, things vital for technology like copper, nickel, rare earths, and most importantly, lithium.
And why the intense focus on lithium?
Because the UK government projects that demand for lithium alone will surge by a staggering 1,100% by 2035. This massive increase is driven by the rapid growth of the electric vehicle market and AI data centers. Securing lithium is now a matter of national economic security.
And Britain is backing this up with a substantial package to accelerate the EV transition itself.
They are. A £1.5 billion or $2 billion package, most of that, $1.7 billion, is for a grant scheme to help consumers buy new electric cars to address that high upfront cost. The rest is for a rapid rollout of charge points.
Now let's return to the structural consequences of government pullback on science services: the privatization of Earth intelligence.
This trend is being directly fueled by the U.S. government's decision to scale back several key climate and Earth science services. It's created a void that private industry is rushing to fill. The private Earth intelligence sector is booming, with revenue expected to exceed $4.2 billion by 2030.
What are these private firms providing that governments are not?
Highly specific, proprietary risk assessments. Services like detailed flood and fire risk assessments for the real estate and insurance sectors. Other firms are expanding satellite constellations to monitor methane emissions at the source. It shifts climate resilience from a public good to a paid service.
And this raises serious questions about data accuracy and access.
It creates a dangerous public-private paradox. These private companies rely heavily on baseline data collected by public agencies like NOAA. If those public agencies are defunded, it affects the quality of the entire sector. More critically, it turns essential climate risk data into a commodity locked behind a paywall.
Meaning poorer nations or local governments could lose the ability to prepare for escalating climate risks.
If they can't pay, exactly.
That structural risk sets up our final segment perfectly, covering global flashpoints where these strategic tensions are manifesting directly.
We begin with a very serious escalation in the Caribbean, the massive military buildup around Venezuela.
The sources detail an extraordinary concentration of American firepower. The USS Gerald R. Ford carrier strike group, at least seven other warships, a nuclear sub, advanced F-35s. The stated mission is counter-narcotics, but that force suggests something far greater.
It's clear that counter-narcotics is a convenient cover. Exclusive sources indicate the U.S. is planning a new phase of Venezuela operations, likely beginning with covert actions. This is framed as combating President Maduro's alleged role in supplying illegal drugs via the Cartel de los Soles.
And this military readiness is already disrupting civilian life.
Absolutely. The FAA issued a severe warning to airlines of potential hazards. In response, three international airlines, Gol, Avianca, and TAP Air Portugal, canceled flights departing from Caracas. The risk is now officially recognized as dangerous for civil aviation.
And the U.S. is also preparing to give itself more flexibility for direct military action.
Yes, by planning to designate the Cartel de los Soles a foreign terrorist organization, or FTO, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth noted this brings a whole bunch of new options to the United States. FTO designation allows the U.S. to freeze assets, ban transactions, and critically, potentially strike Maduro's assets and infrastructure.
Moving to the Asia-Pacific, tensions between China and Japan over Taiwan have escalated dramatically.
This is a major diplomatic crisis. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi called comments made by Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi shocking, accusing Japan of attempting to intervene militarily in the Taiwan Strait.
What specifically did PM Takaichi say that provoked this?
Her statement was carefully constructed but enormously consequential. She said that a hypothetical Chinese attack on Taiwan could be legally deemed a situation threatening Japan's survival.
And that legal designation is key.
It is, as it permits Japan to deploy its military in collective self-defense of an ally. China sees this as an unacceptable shift toward military interventionism.
And China has taken this dispute to the highest diplomatic stage.
They raised the issue with the UN Secretary General, vowing that if Japan attempts armed intervention, China will resolutely exercise its right of self-defense.
On a slightly more positive note, military-to-military communications between the U.S. and China seem to be restoring.
They are. The two militaries held frank and constructive maritime security talks in Hawaii. This restoration of the military-maritime consultative agreement is critical after months of severed communication. It allows them to discuss encounters and hopefully prevent miscalculation.
We also have disappointing news for India's defense industry.
The crash of the indigenous Tejas fighter jet at the Dubai Air Show is a significant setback. The jet, developed over four decades, crashed during a key showcase event that was attended by representatives of India's arch-rival Pakistan. The public failure will inevitably dampen export hopes.
Now, a survey of the situation across Africa, starting with the devastating kidnapping crisis in Nigeria.
Nigeria is dealing with a severe security crisis. We're seeing one of the worst mass kidnappings on record. More than 300 children and staff were abducted from a Catholic school this week. This follows a deadly attack on a church service earlier in the week. These attacks are primarily motivated by high ransoms.
And in Guinea-Bissau, the political climate remains polarized.
The coup-prone nation held snap presidential elections. President Umaro Sissoko Embalo is seeking a rare second term, but the climate is highly polarized due to questions about his legitimacy and his alleged failure to curb the booming cocaine trade.
It's a key transit point to Europe.
A key transit point, and critics argue the drug trade is more profitable now than ever, fundamentally destabilizing the country's governance.
Finally, a quick note on the G20, held in South Africa.
Despite the high-profile U.S. boycott, South Africa successfully pushed through the Leaders' Declaration, which was celebrated as a commitment to multilateral cooperation. It addressed climate change and debt relief, signaling a clear pushback against the U.S. absence. We also saw positive economic news as Zambia welcomed a ratings upgrade, removing its default status.
Before we move to our final thought, let's quickly cover some of the culture and lifestyle headlines. We lost some icons this week.
Yes, two notable figures. Irish fashion designer Paul Costello passed away at 80. He was the personal designer to Princess Diana. Also, the Italian singer Ornella Vanoni died at 91. She was globally famous for her song L'Appuntamento, which was featured prominently in the film Ocean's 12.
And a story of remarkable resilience. Susan Powder, the fitness guru famous for Stop the Insanity.
Her story is detailed in a new documentary chronicling her fall from massive fame and subsequent bankruptcy. She was reduced to living in a transient hotel in Las Vegas. The documentary tracks her resilience. She's now driving for Uber Eats, but maintains her rage is guiding her toward her second act.
Finally, a quick note on cinema and international politics.
Taiwanese cinema was highlighted when A Foggy Tale, a powerful film set during the island's brutal martial law era, won Best Picture at the Golden Horse Awards. And in Israel, the political clock is ticking loudly. Prime Minister Netanyahu is meeting on the 2026 budget. If it's not approved by March, it will automatically trigger new elections.
We have covered an astonishing, immense amount of ground today, from the core political anxieties around prices and the shocking collapse of DOGE to the extraordinary international gambits in Ukraine and Venezuela.
The sheer volume and complexity of these intersecting events is the true takeaway. I mean, we've seen intense diplomatic brinksmanship, Trump's Ukraine ultimatum, the COP30 deadlock clash directly with the enduring, painful domestic realities here in the U.S., like that 13% rise in Thanksgiving costs, or the bureaucratic cruelty facing 200,000 Ukrainians.
And those visible realities run parallel to the critical, less visible battles over control of data and resources. The shocking allegations that Meta buried causal evidence of user harm, the high-stakes antitrust fight over Google, and the strategic moves by the US and UK to lock down critical mineral supply chains.
It leads us to one final provocative thought for you to carry forward. Based on everything we've analyzed, we saw moments of pure political spectacle this week. Marjorie Taylor Greene quitting Congress and comparing herself to a battered wife, or that bizarre warm alliance between the Democratic Socialist Mamdani and Donald Trump.
Right, the high drama.
Exactly. Now, contrast that high visibility political gesture with the slow, grinding, existential policy realities. The quiet move to privatize essential climate data, or the threat of the U.S. cutting off military aid to Ukraine unless they surrender territory. Which of these two narratives, the dramatic political spectacle or the slow burn policy and resource reality, do you believe will ultimately define the direction of the coming year?
A powerful question to consider, because often the flashiest headlines distract us from the most consequential, lasting policy shifts. Thank you for expertly guiding us through this immense stack of material with such insight.
Thank you. It was a comprehensive deep dive indeed.
And thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.